He was educated as I guess an English major. He came back to the University of Kentucky as a English professor and a poet. And that's where his career ambitions were, in that direction. And somewhere along the way, I've never really had him heard a lot of his own reflections on his own journey, but somewhere the experience in the university, he has the pull of his roots on the land. He finally went to farming part time, and as soon as he was able to afford it, he quit teaching at the university. And in some of his writings, he makes references to his own personal experience among the professionals and scholars at his university, and he doesn't have a whole lot of positive things to say about that experience. There was a group of people here last spring, or maybe in the middle of the winter, who had an opportunity to go hear him in Moscow, Idaho. And it was fun to meet him and hear him speak in his Kentucky accent. And he's a tall, thin fella, kind of ruddy cheeks, and kind of bashful in a way. And I came back after listening to him speak on three or four different occasions that weekend, and people accused me of having adopted his accent. He was a real engaging person, and he speaks with a touch of humor, kind of Abe Lincoln-esque. He came to speak kind of wear two hats. He was invited to by the English department at the University of Idaho to deliver the Ezra Pound lecture. Mm-hmm. Ezra Pound was evidently a native of Idaho, and someone endowed the university with money to bring lecturers. And so he came to be a poet at that particular thing, and there were all sorts of people came for a lot of various reasons: cultural critics, farmers expecting him to say things about land issues and about our culture, and he, for the most part, he read his poetry, which if you've read any, is closely connected with his concern for the earth and land issues and rural culture. The one thing I'd say before we discuss the essay that's real apparent in the book, his first book, The Unsettling of America, which was I think it's probably a collection of essays, but it was published as one work by Sierra Club Press and then by Avon Paperbacks, called The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture, and it's a book in the bookstore now, and I think it's out of print now, and we have maybe 10 copies. It may be reprinted by this time. What he tends to do is say that the thing he does in this book that is maybe not apparent in the essay is that he says our agricultural crisis is the responsibility of everyone, and it's not just the business of farmers and agricultural experts, but we as people who eat and who have maybe rejected or decided against living rurally have affected our agricultural scene, and through that have contributed to what he feels is a demise of culture due to our disregard for the land. This book, I have found, well, it says here, the Los Angeles Times may be one of the most important books of the decade, and it has been true for me personally. It's something that I've always suspected about my agricultural roots, and the fact that my grandparents on my father's side were farmers, and my father has a strong connection with the land. But I always suspected it was sentimentality or some sort of nostalgia back to the land, the good old days sort of thing, until I read his book. And he gives very powerful theological, political, economic reasons for farming as a responsible political activity, economic activity, and cultural activity. And he says it may be the most basic. With that kind of introduction, I told you just about all I know about him. Let's just turn to the essay here, and it's the And another, maybe the last thing I'll say as a way of introduction is that this is the most explicitly theological of any of the essays I've ever read by him. And he says in the beginning, it's a personal task, and that is his long-held belief that Christianity, as usually presented by its organizations, is not earthly enough. And he does get very obviously biblical and theological here in the essay. Anybody have any, you know, like first-hand responses to it? Or?
Like where I live is not very practical because everyone's grain farmers, and you just need so much land to make a go of it once you think about these combines and the outlay you need just to get started.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you inherit it, you can't go back to the land.
Mm-hmm. But that's not even an option for many people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not sure what the purpose would be of saying everyone should go back to the land, but that would necessarily care for the land better than the present system. And it would certainly be an entirely different kind of society, and I'm not sure that those societies that are characterized by having the majority of people on the land are models that were all that superior to what's happening now. Certainly things like health were advanced. Well, if you consider that people living longer, healthier lives is something to be desired, then I would argue that that only happens with an industrial base that he talks only about in negative terms. And for everyone to be in a position of having to work all daylight hours with back-breaking toil, which some enjoy and some do not, is not necessarily the most fulfilling way to use a society.
I guess I can see it as that was his point. I guess, you know, I saw that, you know, granted everyone can't do those things, but the people who, you know, everyone does have a say on what kind of a consumer they are and the kind of people that they vote for and things like that and the kind of policy that goes on. And, you know, being responsible for the land doesn't just mean, you know, hoeing your bit of turf. It, you know, has to do with, you know, our use of resources and things of that nature.
I like his, he talks about people only referring to the Genesis and saying, subdue the earth. He turns around and says to find it adequately treated is necessary to turn to a more complex story than that of Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
That meaning the giving of the promised land.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what we reviewed on Wednesday. It was a long struggle of memory and history in how to be in the land and out of the land. Bill is right in a lot of senses that people who have been settled in agricultural have not always been idyllic cultures in that way. And the history of Israel is one that through that way.
I don't mean to say that I don't like anything he has to say. He certainly makes a great deal more sense than Lynn White Jr.
What?
More sense than what?
Lynn White Jr., who wrote that essay on that he refers to there, the roots of the ecological crisis, blaming interpretation of two verses in Genesis for all of the greed of Western society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other kind of general comments?
You describe stewardship as an appropriate discipline. That's like the description of that as a discipline.
Okay. To be a steward implies to practice stewardship. That's one thing that's characteristic of his writing, is that there is always a practical reality in the side to one's virtues and ideas.
And also it struck me in the last section there where he's talking about the stewardship, and that if we lose stewardship, we lose fellowship. And then in the last paragraph, he refers to our alienation from the creation of the land, and that being a lonely situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think back to the Vespers that Kathy Gordon gave, where she read Chief Seattle's speech and showed slides of the mountains and valleys in this area and other parts of the Northwest. And, talked about the Indians' great sense of attachment, I guess you would say fellowship, not only with themselves, but with the land. Connection.
It was an interesting idea that fellowship for probably Chief Seattle and for, it involves more than just human to human contact.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And so that's maybe a connection between work and place, another way to say it, that stewardship may be work. Or fellowship. When we conceive of work, it's toward and serving. It's toward an increase in fellowship and shalom between people. Stewardship refers to place, and that the two are connected is one of the things that he said. Yeah. Yeah.
And together with that, the whole idea too, on the second or third page, where he talks about that the land is always a gift, it's always given. And that no matter what our situation is, how we obtain the land, it's still a fun gift. We have to treat it as such.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Not maybe for, maybe for a shorter period of time than we expected.
Not a gift to own, but a gift to use tentatively.
Tentatively, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you think of the connection he made between the conquest of Canaan by Joshua and everybody and our own settling of America? He didn't pull any punches in saying that he found that the claims for nationalistic manifest destiny on the part of Israel were just as illegitimate as our own. That they hyped up and rationalized it by saying God had given them this land. That's a pretty harsh judgment on it, but it draws a parallel to our situation. Barry starts out the book by saying that there are two ways to be in the land, just like we talked about Wednesday on Settling America. There is the exploiter mentality, and the first words in there. The continent is said to have been discovered by an Italian who was on his way to India. And that was the sort of lack of intention to settle and to be regardful of where you were at. The tendency has been to keep moving west to exploit and use, and when things were used up, to go and push further west. So there's the subordinate tendency has been to stay in the land and be settled and say, this is the place. Maybe if you feel maybe that was a little bit too harsh to identify that sort of conquest, that to say that America has made conquest of our nation. And
I don't think it's too harsh what he has to say about us. I'm not an Old Testament scholar, you know how what he says about Israel really is.
Well,
I don't think it's that specific to America, or the American manifest
process in the act. I think it fits in the whole picture of world history, and it wasn't just the U.S. that was doing it.
Uh-huh. And the main difference may be that we were able to do it with the land that was right next door more than other countries
and
who had to go thousands of miles away to do the
right.
same thing.
But not to say that that justifies it, I'm not saying that at all.
Uh-huh. But it seems
saying that I can see it in historical.
More universal than just
yes.
American. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I appreciate Tom's sessions on civil religion, how Puritans or pilgrims came over with good intentions that they were going to set the model kingdom.
Yeah.
And they just got converted.
Uh-huh. Yeah, didn't they sit in the Mayflower and read passages about the conquest into Canaan and really conceived of themselves as entering the promised land?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It seems like the parallels in the histories are could be very instructive. The question that always occurs to me is then, what is our Christian responsibility there? Given that we are to make the history of Israel our history and learn from that history which is now ours, and that there is a way to be in the land and responsible and stewards, what does it say about how we've done it, you know, and our own participation in it?
To me, he kind of says that there's a certain way that you should go about being stewards, and there's a good way to do it and a bad way to do it, sort of. He talks about doing good. You have to do good for good intentions, and then you have to actually do good,
mm-hmm.
because you can have good intentions and be harmful. And he talks about the people who are trying to be saviors of the world or whatever, who aren't
mm-hmm.
going about
the heroes, yeah.
Yeah, very, yeah, very helpful at all in what they're doing, and that you should kind of get down and be active on a day-to-day level, and that's how you should, you know, be stewards and baptize them.
So I keep coming back to one thing you told me once that Wendell Berry said, and I don't know if it's in that book or not, but that there are no ends. There are only means. And it just keeps hitting me that maybe that's what part of the answer is, that we can't see the land as a means to our end, or anything, or war as a means to peace, or anything like that. There only are means. Seriously,
uh-huh.
The way we go about doing something on a very local, intimate level says a lot about what our ends are.
Yeah, did everyone get that? To talk about ends and means, that when someone says there are no ends, only means. Does anyone, is that any strongly favorable or unfavorable reactions?
That idea ties in with the fact that it was somebody else's before it was ours, and it's going to be someone after ours after we leave.
Well, does that make a difference?
Yeah.
How many people consider those sorts of things when you enter a place? Or I don't. I mean, not by habit or by some sort of instinct or good Hebrew memory, you know.
And do you consider whether it's yours or whether it
would be somebody else's? Yeah. I've heard old farmers say that I've come to this land to, you know, I want to leave it, their only ambition is to leave it in better shape than they found it. And that strikes me as kind of odd, you know, and the first time I heard it seemed like a very sort of humble, short, you know, far-sighted ambition, almost to the point of being hope irrelevant, or, you know, not something that would give me motivation for my life. And then I realized that my goals have been a lot, really fairly short-sighted.
You know, what I do is I don't am not touching the land, but I go to a supermarket, and if I pick up something that I don't want, an aisle later I'll just throw it, put it on a shelf where it doesn't belong. And how many other people do that? Or do you always take it back to the place where it belongs? Well, I feel too. But it seems to be it's an opposite extreme of what you're talking about. Because there's a stop point that puts it back.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing that's going on in littering, I think.
The same thing that's going on where?
In littering. You know, the idea that places are not storied kind of places with meaning, but they're just spaces, you know, and you can kind of work your own will in it. Yeah, I've done that too.
It makes jobs.
I'd like to ask about those farmers' concept of what better than they found it means.
Well,
that there are some people who consider that a technological production facility, which is what many farms are, has some real disadvantages compared to the swamp that was drained originally.
Yeah, well, the specific one I was talking to meant leaving the soil in more fertile condition, the houses and barns in better shape, the woodlot in good shape, that sort of thing. The ones that talk about technological advance, and I'm generalizing a little bit from my experience, are living from year to year, you know, to pay the bills. And I'm afraid that's how I have, you know, I have not been in a place long enough that I could ever, you know, one of my ambitions in college was to find a place, settle down, and plant the trees, the walnut trees that I would build with when I entered retirement. And I've never been in a place to realize that sort of care. I can buy them. I mean, there are people cutting down walnut trees God knows where, and I can just go and buy them. Yeah.
I know that my perspective changed a lot. Well, I've been living in the city, and I'd heard about recycling and stuff, and yet right there in the city there's always a garbage truck that took my garbage away. I went up north with a group to a camp that's in an area where it's pretty much just a small layer of soil and then sand underneath it. Mm-hmm. And understanding working with organic gardening, understanding building up soil and such, when it came time for us to dispose of the garbage that we had, it was a small group, maybe only about 40 people, but we were asked to dig a garbage pit. And the idea was just that they were going to be throwing everything into the garbage pit and mm-hmm. then covering it up. And I thought, I mean, even a small amount of time, a week, all the cans and all the glass that they used, you could really see that you could either be really destructive to the land very fast by just pouring all the stuff into the land, or else you could be really building up the soil and nurturing the place.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people couldn't understand that concept because they were coming from the city, but somehow, with my gardening perspective, I could understand that mm-hmm. a little bit better. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we are apart from that perspective.
Yeah. Is anyone ever just kind of daydreamed and thought of the consequences of all their activities? I mean, that's kind of a big... I sit around and do that all the time. I think it was Wendell Berry's writing that first brought it home to me, that he said the one reason he holds up farming as a paradigm is because you live very closely with the consequences of your work. That everything you do, everything you use and are through with somehow stays around you. You know, the human waste at one time, and especially in the 40 centuries that people have been farming in China, have always been used to replenish the soil. And it's from what I hear about Chinese culture is that many farmers in search of human shit would build very elaborate outhouses along the side of the road for travelers, you know, and sort of inviting them in rather than these big plastic signs that says buy here, you know. It was another sort of invitation, and they sort of competed for use of that, and there were contracts out to buy cities human refuse, you know, and thousands of dollars or yen or whatever they were paid for that sort of thing. Farming farming is maybe the one most obvious way in this country that the consequences of human activity in life have been lived with by the people who produced them. Our life is very different from that, and it's different in that way from, you know, all the generations of human activity and culture before us, which were primarily agriculture and lived close to their consequences. When we work, we don't work at home, and the consequences of our work are spread out throughout the world. We are paid in money. The money then goes to provision our homes by buying products that have all sorts of implications and consequences throughout the world. We bring those products home, we use them, produce waste and garbage, and put it in a can outside our house or flush it down the tubes, and it's out of our immediate vicinity, but it has certain consequences elsewhere. And if you begin to think about how our life in our working and in our consuming begins to have consequences throughout the world and consequences we've never even thought about, you can understand how we can find ourselves in a culture that's mired in waste and garbage and all sorts of dire consequences, and no one seems to be to blame.
Is there Wendell Berry that says about thinking globally and acting locally? Because I think that's what...
It would be consistent with him. He does make statements. He makes a statement in The Unsettling where he says there is no such thing as the global village. And his point is that that as long as we disregard the consequences and how we live in our locality, we can never hope to impose global solutions, that there are no global solutions, or there are only local solutions. And he said at Idaho that there is no world hunger problem. There's a hunger problem in this village or in that village, and to conceive of it as a global problem is to preserve the problem and compound it.
I think a lot of the issue is we just take it all for granted. We don't. So we have water to drink, but if it smells too much like chlorine, that's what you need.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Part of a public health class I had in college was having to go to the sewer plant and the water treatment plant, or making a clean plant for wherever we grew up. I'd never gone to those places before, or even knew where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the megatons of stuff that has to get rid of.
Yeah.
I think that not many of us ever even do that.
Yeah. Skull time. How many people have been down to visit the Holden Village holding tank? Do you know where it goes? It's, you know, it's down, there's a little road, that ignominious road, that starts from the volleyball court and ends in a very smelly site. And there's a room, you know, a big, well, I don't know exactly, it's sort of like a basement with a small roof over the top of it. And there are people in this village who actually have to go in there and do things. Jack, have you been in there? Mark Hungerford spent a lot of time in there. It would be probably, as long as you're here and the consequences of Holden's life are within walking distance, and you can see where everything happens here, and you can go to the hydro, you can go to the warehouse and see what happens to the cans, you can follow the garbologist around, you can go down and see the waste disposal system. It would be a good opportunity to avail yourself of that and begin thinking of what the consequences of our kind of up till now thoughtless actions are. I think you could probably get a pair of boots too if you want to inspect it closer.
It doesn't end down there.
No, it doesn't. It then gets pumped across to the tailings.
And it seems to be the best hope for reclamation of the table.
Mm-hmm. And it is that which is nourishing our Jerusalem artichokes.
Yeah. Which feed the deer on occasion, I noticed.
Which then feed the hunters who come up from somewhere.
Which then come through the village and fertilize the lawn.
We're beginning to talk about a sort of cyclical understanding of creation and about the kind of shalom and heart. This is good. The shalom vision is coming out. Yeah.
On page 274 of the essay, and then on page 275, he's talking about what charity is and the practical, the practice of charity. He says, real charity calls for the study of agriculture, and he goes on, he says, making pictures, songs, stories, and that these things, the choice must be made whether these are used charitably or uncharitably. And he says, how can we love our neighbor if we can't mend a fence or help him with his water supply? But how can I be charitable, or how can I love in a society that that sends its chemicals to a country that doesn't have any restrictions on chemicals that we know to be hazardous?
Mm-hmm.
How do I live in a land?
that seems to be the question. That
I mean, it's the same question we ended with the other day.
Uh-huh. I think it's more complex for us, is because we don't know, we no longer have that kind of control over our consequences, the consequences of what we do.
So what does that mean about our position, our situation?
Well, in some ways it's almost hopeless, it seems. The one that seems to be, that seems to be affecting more and more people as a responsible economic and political response is to begin to take hold of your consequences. You know, that the response of faith is to make sure the consequences that leave your work and your activity are charitable. And that has to be the theological motivation and reason behind any movement of back to the land or simplified lifestyle. It's not you're going to pick an issue here and pick an issue there, but the overall issue is that you're going to make the consequences of your life charitable. And so rather than looking at back to the land or living simply or living self-reliantly as an escape from the world of interdependence, it's actually a way to take control of the innumerable consequences of your life, to begin to try to make them charitable rather than unknown and uncontrolled and destructive. And he says right out and out that gardening, this is another essay that we almost had instead of this one, that gardening is a responsible political and economic protest and activity. It's in an essay that I think appeared in a journal someplace called The Reactor and the Garden. And he tells a story about how he went over the fence at a nuclear reactor across the river in Tennessee, I think it was, or maybe it was in Kentucky, and said that sort of thing needs to be done, but he has no illusions about the limitations of that sort of public protest. And then he goes on to talk about how the vacuum created by negative protest has to be filled with some sort of positive response. And gardening for him is a political act. I recommend the essay to you. But if there are any, maybe I should ask that question. Does the idea of being self-reliant strike anybody as uncharitable, or that there are certain risks to world shalom mm-hmm. in that it seems more like escapism?
Smacks of real individualism against kind of community effort.
Okay, and in a lot of ways it's being practiced that way. People go off and try to isolate themselves.
Yeah. Well, it just was brought closer to me when I came through. I mean, when I was living in Northfield, we were able to have a garden and be self-reliant in that area. And then I drove through Montana and realized that all the fruits and all the vegetables that they were getting were all shipped in. They had to be trucked in.
Mm-hmm.
And how do those people live self-reliantly? I mean, there has to be some interaction of the things that they can grow with the things that we can grow too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
about a barter system? I know this is kind of far-fetched, but you can't grow wheat in your garden either. If you want flour, it could be some kind of trade.
But yeah, I think the there has to be some sort of trade too, not just sell.
Yeah, for there to be some sort of reverse migration, to reverse the rural to urban migration that has taken the majority of people in the last 60 years out of the country into the city, it's to reverse it would, I just think about the consequences to Los Angeles, where they can't grow anything but asphalt. You know, and they've stolen water from the surrounding three or four states, you know, to support the millions and millions of people that live there. It is totally dependent upon importing the goods from rural areas, well, probably from half or more. Well, it's inconceivable the number of places that Los Angeles relies on to support the urban life that it used to. And,
what about the need for ministry or the need for service in the cities?
Say it louder, please.
I say, what about the need for service in the cities? I mean, we're talking about the back to the earth movement and setting up an agricultural community and the isolation that sometimes that creates, or the separation from the rest of society. Yeah. What about the work that needs to be done in the cities?
Yeah, it's almost like you're abandoning the urgent, most urgent.
Isn't that where we're called to serve too? Mm-hmm. And how do I serve in that kind of a setting? And still make my work charitable, or still cultivate the skills that will bring about charitable consequences of my life?
Good question.
But a lot of the solutions to problems in the cities are rural solutions. Mm-hmm. I work in,
so does that mean I abandon the situation?
No, but I think you can't ignore rural solutions to urban problems. I mean, those two have been separated for so long, and that's why you have in the south side of Chicago, Robert Taylor homes that are 25 stories, and you discover that you can't raise children 25 stories off the ground very well. And now public housing projects are being redesigned and rehabbed and are closer to the ground and they're more communal and community garden. All sorts of those things are being applied now. Rural values and urban values are more connected. You might not have the kind of big towers and which I think leads to a lot of the vandalism, and I don't know if that fits with anyone else's experience of the city, but
yeah, it seems like sort of a very watertight choice, black and white choice. You go to an urban area, you deal with the most urgent human needs, but at the same time you have to participate in many of the structures and systems that are destructive and are symptoms of the problem. Right? You become a tenant, you rely on maybe a private automobile, you shop at big chain grocery stores, you participate in a lot of ways the destructive things in order to practice a very urgent ministry to the human need, and it's much more obvious in the city. You go to the rural area, you deal with the most basic crisis, not the most urgent, but the most basic. That is a relationship to the earth and how human needs are met from the ground, and ultimately they always are. Something's either dug out of the ground or grown in it in order to meet human need. You find yourself isolated from the most urgent human needs. You find yourself distant from human problems. And the question is there a way to Tom was asking it, to bring a rural consciousness into the city and a consciousness of the city's urgent problems into the country? Is there a way to do that? Can you feel whole living in the city? Can you feel whole and living in the country? Anybody have any answers?
Use window boxes in your place in the city. Grow a garden.
Okay, you're mentioning urban solutions. tub farming, urban farming, cooperatives.
I've heard instances, you know, a lot of people are scared to plant gardens in vacant lots and things, thinking that they'll be vandalized or what grows there will be stolen. But in by example, what happens is that the community becomes, the neighborhood becomes much more conscious of the community and much more caring about it, and so that the reverse is true.
Mm-hmm. That it becomes a respected sort of.
Yeah, I had some friends who went around the neighborhood and tried to get people together to grow an urban garden in a vacant lot that they got permission from their landlord to use, and it worked out really well for them. And I'm not saying that that would work out really well in any neighborhood for anyone, mm-hmm. but that's one thing they tried that I think sort of bridges that gap.
Yeah.
It was exciting when I was up in the city visiting my sister around the neighborhood that she lives in. It's not necessarily community gardens, but each personal plot or each personal house seems to have started gardening in their front yard. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of got to be sort of a trendy thing maybe in the beginning, but now I think everyone's sort of working together and it's beautiful as well.
Okay.
Another thing that's happened in the neighborhood of our church is that strip where they were going to put a superhighway has been vacant for about 20 years, and the Laotians or the Vietnamese have been gardening in the strip now in the last couple of years, and I think it's awakened a lot of interest in the community and a way for them to communicate with the community.
Has there been much vandalism with that?
I really don't know for sure, but I think there is much less than you would expect.
Yeah.
Every day. Yeah. It seems to be very well respected.
That's interesting. I sometimes wonder if it might just be that it's not even recognized as a target for vandalism, or that street punks don't know how to vandalize a garden. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe when we see gardens being vandalized, there'll be a little more hope.
Well, there are obvious things to do in the city. Recycling is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Growing plants so that can absorb some of the pollutants in the air and reduce noise. Eating co-op type food and being active there.
I know there are
riding markets. Riding your bike or walking whenever you can. Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the biggest things, you know, to be responsible for. And just, you know, we're such a consumer society, just, you know, being responsible consumers and not getting so pulled in by what, you know, we're told we need and told we have to have, and things and how they're packaged and what's in them and what you're feeding your kids and what you throw away when you're supposedly done with this product. You throw away.
Yeah, you won't find any antique waste baskets. There just weren't any. Bill?
One of the things that disturbed me about the article was that he seemed to feel that regulations were a counterproductive way to deal with problems. And it seems to me that if we have to assume some kind of collective society, some kind of urbanization, that regulations are absolutely necessary for the conduct of that society. And I think that puts another kind of responsibility on individuals to try to bring about group action in the form of regulations.
Yeah.
And as far as agriculture close to urban areas, which seems to me to fit in at least to being a step in the direction he's talking about, is the tax policies that are the biggest hassle in that today, at least in our cities. And a lot of people have tried to work towards some kind of community purchase of development rights to make it financially possible for farmers to keep farming.
Yeah, I think his main criticism of regulation is that people so often abdicate responsibility.
But when the regulations came about because of
the responsibilities
large numbers of
people. Of
individuals getting together and demanding them, not
yeah.
because of power structures putting them into effect.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, you need to
the point. This summer there was a movie shown called The Near Edge. It was like examples of four different groups of people practicing different alternatives of either simplified living or whatever. And the discussion after the movie was really interesting. It was a summer crowd, so it was just guests from all over the country, but I suppose mostly Lutheran. But when we started talking about simplified living, and some suggestions were made, a lot of people really stammered and said, sure, that's fine for you to do that, but that's not going to solve any world hunger problems. And okay, your conscience can be clear and you can live better, but you know, what is that going to solve? And what do you answer?
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that, too, I think, well, I don't know, maybe they don't want to see their personal connection to it. And want the kindest people to deal with it, but I don't know how to answer it.
Yeah, it seems that part of it is an issue of not being aware that everything you do has consequences that are kind of scattered around the globe. And I think of the way Wendell Berry starts talking about the kind of public solutions we've seen. We live the lifestyle that we can pay for, and then use our surplus to help pay for improvements in the rest of the world. Sort of institutional policy sorts of solutions. And he takes his, well, the Sierra Club, who had published his book, he includes in this, like the second chapter, he said that it was to the embarrassment of the Sierra Club, someone in investigating their investment activities found that Sierra Club had many of its funds invested in some companies with the most atrocious environmental records, like offshore oil drilling companies and strip mine companies in Kentucky. And I thought it was real brave of the Sierra Club to go ahead and publish this book. His point was that although you know seeking policy changes and solutions are very important, we have a crisis. It reveals a crisis of character in that we consider that the only solution. And that this is the way solutions are worked. And his point is that he said that the Sierra Club did clean up their act, but he said that's not the exception; it's the rule. That the consequences of our action are very inconsistent and oftentimes unknown to us. And he says the only way to get down to the basic cause of some of our the crises that confront us are to become responsible as a person, as an individual.
I'd like to say I spent about the last 15 years of my life doing that. It's a prescription for pure insanity. I'm not kidding.
You mean pursuing policy changes?
Just or? Saying to yourself, I am going to do everything as responsibly as I know how. And when you start studying knowing how, you start separating your paper into boxes. Five or six different kinds till you get 300 pounds of each kind, which will be accepted at the local recycling station. Then you decide how many bicycles you're going to have, and you're going to ride your bicycle, but then you're going to say to yourself, gee, I may put those guys out of business if I don't make holes in the road. And then you flush a toilet in the largest unsewered area in Parkland, or the Parkland area is in the whole United States, and you feel guilty every time you flush it. Because you know where it's going and what it's doing, and maybe in your groundwater because you're drinking well water right there. And then your husband works at an institution that has a whole lot more students in it than it ought to have for its sewage system. So you're saying to yourself, should I get involved in the PLU politics so they'll make a bigger sewage system, or should I go after the county to make a big sewage system? I mean, I'm talking about a prescription for insanity.
How did we get? How did we get to that position? How did we get there?
How do we live next door to the Ford Air Force Station? The noise drives me insane. And on the other block, there's Pacific Avenue, 25,000 cars running up and down it, and trucks from off the mountain with every 5 minutes going past your grade school. How do you get them to shut up? It's impossible. If you start thinking about it, don't think too long.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to a moral dilemma, because I think that's what when we looked at the history of Israel and the land, and the fact that their focus was how to meet the rigorous conditions under which they were given the land as a gift. If that history is our history, we have to approach land and where we live and our place the same sort of way. And right now, the agenda drives us insane, because for 400 or 500 years we've allowed the accretion of complex industrial economy to come unexamined. We've progress was inevitable, and we did whatever we could do, and whatever we could do was right, and we're reaping the harvest of it now, and it drives you crazy.
I have one simplistic idea that came to me in the middle of an energy course one time, and that was, if every manufacturer had to take back his product when somebody was through with it. In other words, when your shirt's worn out, you take it back to the source of where you purchased it, the bond. The bond would have to send that rotten shirt back to the original manufacturer. They would have to take it apart and do with it whatever they could. They wouldn't put chemicals in your clothes or whatever that wouldn't work for mm-hmm. them to take apart. That's the only thing I can think of that might be a possible solution.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do about the mail.
Well, the fact that we've arrived at that point, so well, you know what the Italians do. Yeah. Yeah. Well, if we had a less efficient postal system, the one in Italy, whenever they get behind, they just take it out and burn it. That's a radical solution for the problem.
The incinerator and garbage truck traffic at our local post office have blocked the way.
Hey, listen, they come after 2 days, big blue dumpsters full twice a week.
It's interesting. You know, the change was even visible in my lifetime, because when I was a little kid, people still got milk bottles and put them out.
Yeah, try to get them now. We did. We tried to get them. You can't get them.
I know. Just in, you know, in the past 20 years, I've noticed that sort of change. You ever seen a hospital dumpster? Now that may be the one defensible place for throwaway items, because the concern there is for sanitation. But it's maybe representative. Huh? It's appalling. It's appalling, the things that are paid for and then 5 minutes later are heaved into the dumpster. There was a woman here that left, well, Marilyn Finn and Kathleen Grimbley and Holly Henderson, Holly Bell Henderson. Some of you might know them. They went to a conference at Whitworth College, and Kathleen Grimbley taught them how to scrounge in dumpsters, and they ate for the weekend out of dumpsters. They did pretty well, they thought.
There was a meal made for the senators once, made out of food scrounged from the dumpsters. You know, frozen mm-hmm. dinners that had partially thawed, and so the supermarkets couldn't keep them, and all sorts of, you know, packaged foods, which maybe the label was torn off of, and so the supermarket would just throw it out, or the restaurant would just throw it out. And, you know, a gourmet meal made out of dumpster food that couldn't legally be sold.
Mm-hmm. We can talk about all the specifics until we're blue in the face. The faith issue that emerges for me is that of stewardship, and the discipline of stewardship. To be a steward, as we're called, and to execute that rigorous conditions of our being given any land at all as a gift. And this, we're looking now as the whole creation is a gift, is that we have to begin to take control of our consequences. And that involves work, and that page that you pointed out, Linnea, that I think, or maybe it's the following one, Barry asks, aren't there some activities, given that sort of criteria, that isn't there some work that's illegitimate? We have to ask that question about the work, and we have to ask our question how our work and our activity affects the place, the creation.
I have another question. On the top of page 281 there at the end of that first paragraph, he's talking about, he refers beforehand to work in a particular place and the long-term result. And then the last line there says, perhaps the real work, like real prayer and real charity, must be done in secret. What does he mean by that? And he goes on to talk about the real study of stewardship then to know.
Okay. What lies before us in daily life? I immediately think of what we talked about on Monday, the idea of work as an assumption. He's using this to talk about doing real work in secret as work opposed to the kind of industrial heroism that we normally conceive of our life's work as something that's going to be challenging, important, significant. We try to choose careers in that direction. And I think what he is saying is that that is not nearly as important as how you throw away what you use, or if you throw away it at all. What kind of food you eat, the very small decisions you make. And that for me relates to what we talked about Monday about our choice of career, you know, careers have to fit such a fulfillment agenda for us that they have to be everything to us. And the biblical assumption and the ancient world assumption was that it was for daily bread, it was for the community health, and there was, you can look, and outside the passages in the New Testament that talk about the calls to act, you know, functions and vocations within the community of faith, you will not find one job elevated above another. You will not find that sort of a distinction, but it's assumed that everyone will take part in significant work that's significant for the daily health of the individual and the community. You know? And I think that's part of the biblical way of seeing work, is that the question of what's important and significant becomes less weighty, and what is responsible becomes more important.
Sounds kind of
communistic. It sounds, in some ways, it sounds kind of depressing. Everybody wants to do fun, significant work. And what he's saying is that there is redemptive possibilities in what we call drudgery.
Do drudgery for the sake of doing drudgery is crazy.
Yeah, well, see, given his assumptions about the kind of work, the work that is closely related to the ground, he makes a distinction between meaningful work and labor, or work and labor, and that much of the meaning has been taken out of it because it isn't connected with the ground and you don't know the consequences. And he'd be the first to admit that putting a single bolt in the new Mustang II would be drudgery. But he says that they're given a certain view of work, that the work that people consider raising food, which by a certain view is looked upon as drudgery, is full of some of the most important human rewards and fulfillments, and we have just become blind to them. So there would be a distinction between manual work that is fulfilling and that which is just mere labor.
And you could switch around though. We brag today about how only 3-4% of the population is involved in directly raising food for the other 96% or 97%. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
We brag about that, but you could be depressed about the fact that, you know, how many thousands of people have to go to work every day in a suit and tie and ride the bus and shuffle paper
and shell out money for our Safeway brand. Yeah. An interesting statistic I came across in the Christian Science Monitor said that, and this was amazing, it said that 40% of families in America grow either some or all of their own vegetables in this last year. 40%.
be economically feasible again, whereas 15 or 20 years ago it wasn't.
Yeah. And again, the issue for us is not that it's just economically feasible, but that it's responsible stewardship.
It tastes better, too.
Well, there's that, too.
Yeah. And yet, I still wonder whether the shamefully exploited migrant workers would be better off back in Mexico.
That were they not itinerant pickers for our disregard of agriculture, that's another consequence of our desire for cheap, inexpensive food in which we have no part, the raising of which we have no part, is that the lowest class of society is those who pick our food for us.
But is it an improving of their status to take even that from them, rather than trying to treat them as human beings too, with decent working conditions and a living wage, and pay more for food than we buy?
I don't know. But if everyone raised their garden, we would have, migrant workers would have no option instead of the one bad one. Yeah.
If things were better for them at home, they wouldn't come to do what they do.
Yeah.
That's the same argument that the church has used a long time against investment in South Africa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes down to treating the Mexicans or the Guatemalans or whoever with justice in the first place, so that they don't have to take the bad option of being illegal immigrants and working in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we do that? That's a question I don't see really addressed in what we're talking about. And maybe it's a separate question, but he's saying that global thinking, which to me includes that, is counterproductive.
He says it's never adequate.
Yeah.
Yeah. By itself.
He says you have to do something.
Yeah. Well, I think the other responsibility to be stewards that he talks about is to be neighborly. And that may include the responsibility as if and when our economic or cultural assumptions about raising food and division of labor change, we'll have a responsibility for those that are hurt by the change. And how to take responsibility is a complex, it's a complex question.
Bringing it down to a real simplistic one. One co-op that I heard about in the cities questioned whether it would be right politically to sell bananas. And there was such a demand for getting bananas that they decided that they would sell bananas, but they upped the price so much that the extra money that they got from selling the bananas, they also used in trying to work toward changing the system. And I don't know exactly how that money is actually used, but if you could kind of do a both and for a poll, you're supporting some of the things, also changing, raising extra money to change the system, would be implemented. But
the other thing that occurs to me is that we are the government, and if we're not actively doing our responsibilities towards what happens with the government, then we're letting it slide by. And I think we're seeing the result of a lot of neglect, because I've been at lots of public hearings when I was the only public at the public hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of times.
Labeled crazy.
Yep. Labeled bad fly, labeled there comes that bird lady on the bottom line. But they talk sometimes now about mining garbage dumps in Pierce County.
Mining?
That was said at a public hearing by one of the county commissioners a while back, because the birders were down there telling them that they're going to have to do something like this.
You mean putting mines in there to?
No, no.
I mean going in there to mine the fence,
Richard.
get the steel back out, and the hunting through it for the aluminum and separation of the stuff. And
better ore than they're importing now.
Yeah.
Because they're getting full.
Interesting. What time is it? Are we? What's our official quitting time? 12? Never mind. No, I don't have any concluding words either. Does anyone else have any?
Neither did Wendell Bear.
Well, to be fair to him, he does say the solution is as yet unthinkable. So, and that's as much a, that's very disturbing for him.
And I'm only frustrated by that because I think his theological and philosophical basis is so completely sound. And I, what can we do with this?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we are. Maybe it's just a step to realize we are a problem. I mean, I don't mean that as a guilt trip, but we all drink coffee, you know, we all like our bananas, we all like tomatoes in the winter. I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're it.
Maybe we can work on our own. Yeah. Yeah. He always says that the public solutions are necessary, but they're, you know, they're never enough, and it requires some personal kind of commitment. And that seems to match in a lot of ways the kind of ethics that we've learned as Christians. That one. There are certain personal virtues and community virtues that must be practiced, and then our the great traditions of the church of being in a global vision of ministry and justice. And however we've practiced it, at least it's always been part of our thinking.
And perhaps the frustration is the message too, that at the end we are all unprofitable servants.
Yeah.
You
don't
have
this whole bit of it. No, I don't. Yeah, I think Dana, did Dana read it for a Vespers?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'd just recommend his books. He's a very lonely voice. I read a review in one of these huge volumes of, you know, the Encyclopedia of American Literature or something, as some reference work. And he was dismissed by the reviewer as, well, Wendell Berry's biggest problem is that he's old-fashioned. And of course, he bridles at that. He says he's not talking about going backwards. He's talking about values that have constant validity. And the notion of progress that gives rise to that criticism is one of our worst enemies.
About that against being the progressive thinkers or the innovators in line of constant practical ways of doing things.
Yeah. Yeah. How many times have you heard people say, well, wait, science will come up with a substitute for gasoline and then our problems will be solved? He says the problem is not waiting for a breakthrough. The problem is that we have never been disciplined about our use of energy. And that will never help us become disciplined. Well, thank you. I would encourage you to kind of look at his books. We have one in the bookstore, The Unsettling, and I think we have quite a number in the library. And if there's enough demand for this book, Mary will order it before you go. The Gift of Good Land, and where this book was a criticism of culture, all the essays in the book, except the last one, the majority of them deal with his search after having written this book. People say, well, what can we do? And he has gone and visited different cultures and places and have established some evidence that there are workable solutions. He has visited a historian, an archaeologist that took him down to show him the ancient ruins of the potato civilizations in Peru where thousands of people lived on very few acres and maintained and built the fertility on the steep mountain slopes, that there were cultures that had retained vestiges of that. He visited Native American cultures in the Southwest, a Kentucky farmer that had bought a strip mine for nothing and with the help of a bulldozer in the last 20 years had reclaimed it all by himself and on his own motivation. Yeah, well, thanks for having me.